Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober, covering lifestyles in the world of real food. On October 17th, the Weston A. Price Foundation will be holding its annual Wise Traditions Conference, this year in Salt Lake City, Utah. As has been the tradition on The Appropriate Omnivore, I'll be interviewing several of the upcoming speakers. This week's speaker is Judith McGeary, founder of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, or FARFA as it's commonly known. Judith is an attorney, activist, and regenerative farmer. She founded FARFA to promote common sense agricultural policies. Her Wise Traditions presentation is entitled Changing Laws That Govern Our Food System. Judith, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, and I'm always glad to have you on. And as I read all the things that you do, an activist, an attorney, a farmer, and running FARFA, I'm glad that you can take the time out of your busy schedule to come on here.
Always. And talking with people, activism starts at the base. It starts with people knowing what's happening and how they can make a difference.
Very true. Yes, I see my podcast as part of the activism. So a lot has been going on in Texas and in the country. So I know that FARFA has been busy with them, and you'll have great material to talk about at this year's conference for your presentation. One of the big accomplishments with Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance were the new cottage food laws in Texas. Tell us about those.
So this is the culmination of 15 years of work and change. Back in 2011, it was illegal in Texas to make any food in your home kitchen and sell it. And at that point, there were maybe only 10 states or so that had laws that allowed people to make food in their home kitchens and sell it. And so in 2011, we get through this itty bitty tiny bill that simply allowed people to make non-refrigerated baked goods, jams and jellies, and dried herbs and sell it directly to consumers at their home. The customer had to come to their residence and buy it right there and then. And it was this immense battle. It was a knockdown, drag out, everybody fighting to get this little bill through. And then in 2019, we came in and expanded it. And every time it was a big fight and the world was going to come to an end, according to our opponents. And then this year we came in with a major expansion that went into effect on September 1st. The cottage food producers in Texas have immense different opportunities. It's really amazing looking at how far it's come from that first effort.
Wow, a lot of work, over a decade of activism and lobbying for it. That has to be amazing to finally get this done after all that time.
It is. And I just realized I haven't even said what this law does. So what we now have is people can work out of their home kitchens. They can sell up to $150,000 per year of any of these cottage food items. First of all, they can do it anywhere in the state. As long as you, the cottage food producer, or your employee are selling directly to a consumer, you can do it any location, a farmer's market, a retail store, anything. And you can sell pretty much any food except meat, poultry, or seafood, low acid canned foods, raw milk or raw milk products, and frozen desserts. It's not that you can't sell those foods, you just can't sell them as a cottage food producer. If you want to sell those foods, you have to go the normal licensing and regulation route. You also can, and this is a piece that I think is vital in terms of rebuilding the local food system. It's supporting these direct-to-consumer sales, because that's a huge piece, and it's recognizing that's not the only model. We want people to be able to buy things at their local restaurant or at their local cafe or a small mom and pop grocery or co-op. And so the new law also allows the non-refrigerated items, the items that are what's called non-timer temperature controlled for safety foods or shelf stable foods, basically, to be sold one step removed is the phrase I use. It's a wholesale sale to someone who in turn sells direct to consumers. So it's not going into Sysco, but it is going into these local outlets and helping to rebuild a stronger, more vibrant local food system.
Yes, cottage foods, I appreciate you taking time to explain those to people that might not know them. I'm sure our longtime listeners, a lot of them probably familiar with it, but any first-time ones, that's good. And it was something that I had not known about before being involved with Weston A. Price and with Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And since, I've learned certainly a lot about that and known about the importance that they are for people then when they're starting out with making something.
Absolutely. A few years ago, when we first were getting pickles into the law, this was our 2019 version, one of our farmers came up and went door to door with me up at the Capitol. We walked and hit all the key offices. And what he talked about was his main work is a vegetable farmer. This is what he does. He can make so much more money, such a great profit margin if he pickles some of those vegetables. But there's no way it pencils out for him to go spend thousands of dollars and all the hours renting commercial kitchen space and dealing with all the licenses. It's a side piece. Whereas if you allow cottage foods, in 2019, we got pickles into the law. But here's this farmer who has a much more economically viable farm now. Consumers are able to access these incredibly, oh my God, his pickled green beans were amazing. So you have access to these great foods. And when people get to the stage that this is a large enough occupation and a large enough enterprise that it makes sense for them to operate under the regulations, they can move into that option, or they stay in this smaller arena. What we want is to create this diverse web where regulations are scale appropriate and risk appropriate, and that allow businesses of all sizes to be successful and get good food out to the customers.
As you mentioned pickles, you make me hungry because I love pickles, and I'm a pickle maker myself. In fact, I got some fresh pickles that I may do after recording this podcast, so that's a great one to bring up that's near and dear to my heart.
My talk at Weston Price is going to be both about the actual laws, but a lot of the focus is how do you make change? One of the things to recognize and see in the cottage food fight is we have to view this, first of all, as a long-term fight. You have to be ready to win some, to lose some, to keep coming back year after year, and to accept compromises. A lot of times over the years, people have been like, how could you accept that compromise? Well, it got us this one step or maybe three steps closer to where we want to be. And that helps you build strength. And if we come in with a bill like this 10 years ago, they would have been like, you're nuts. We came into this bill with 15 years of cottage food operators behind us where we could say, take a look at the record. There's no foodborne illness outbreaks being traced to these guys. There is not a single foodborne illness outbreak that's been linked to a cottage food producer in Texas. Being able to come in with a track record. And it was a huge step up in being able to get a law like this passed.
And as you mentioned, this was 15 years in the process. And you talked at the beginning about how 15 years ago, there weren't that many states that had cottage food laws. Have there been other states since which have passed cottage food laws?
Yes, I think at this point, literally every state has some sort of either. Now, a lot of it's statutory, some of it's regulatory, but every state has something. Some of them are really small. Some of it's $5,000 of baked goods. Some of it's even wider than Texas. Wyoming has what we call a food freedom law, which is whatever it is, as long as it's not meat, because USDA won't let you do meat, you can sell it direct to consumers. So those are two ends of the spectrum. Texas is now towards the upper end. We're near Wyoming. Not quite there. But every state has something. Every state has some version. And it was part of, again, growing this movement step by step and continuing. It's not over yet by any means.
Yes, that was going to be my follow-up question is, since passing this law, do you have plans to expand the cottage food law into more areas in Texas?
So as the cottage food law allows for pretty much completely unregulated sales of these foods, I don't anticipate us coming in trying to get more included. Low acid canned foods aren't in it. Raw milk isn't in it. On-farm poultry isn't in it. So there's just a few that could, and there's reasons that they're not. So the cottage food law in Texas, I don't anticipate coming in for another reform, but there's other areas of reform. It's part of the broader movement of how do we remove regulatory barriers that are keeping small farmers from accessing markets and getting their food to consumers. And there's certainly more work to do there. We worked on another bill in Texas on eggs and allowing ungraded eggs to be sold at restaurants and retailers. Almost made it through. It passed the Senate and it was on the calendar for a vote by the whole House the last day of the session. And the clock struck midnight on us. We ran out of time. So we're going to work on that. We work on the federal level on meat processing regs. There's a lot of space still for making improvements in the regulatory system, certainly.
Yes, and I'd like to get into those in more detail. So first, you brought up the Local Eggs Act. Explain exactly what that involved.
So this should be such an easy bill. This is where you get these situations when you work on policy where you just have to recognize that common sense and how hard or how easy it is to get a reform through just don't match. So in nationally, what's the case pretty much is that farmers can generally sell ungraded eggs directly to consumers. Grading is simply where you take those eggs, you weigh them, you sort them by size, large, extra large, medium. You candle them, which means you take a high powered flashlight basically and shine a light through them. And based on the size of the air pocket and whether there's blood spots or white, everyone's cracked open the eggs and you get that white stringy stuff mm-hmm. in the egg whites. Based on how many of those eggs have a blood spot or have those white threads and the size of the air pocket, you classify them as either grade A, grade AA, grade B, etc. Notice that this is all just gross physical examination, what's visible to your eyes. Salmonella, Campylobacter, the bacteria that cause foodborne illnesses, guess what? You can't see them when you do this. You can't prevent them. You can't detect them. And so even USDA, which runs the grading program, says very explicitly that this is not a food safety measure. It is an issue of marketing and basically predictability, that consumers know what they're buying, which is great. I'm all in favor of that, particularly if they're buying at a grocery store some mass-produced conventional product. But why can't some local small mom-and-pop grocer carry the local farmer's ungraded eggs? That's fine. Label it ungraded. They can pop open. They can see what size it is. It's pretty straightforward. And seriously, the poultry industry acts like this is going to be the end of the universe. And this was actually our fourth session working on this bill. We've tried getting this bill through four times. And each time we get further, each time we've pushed it further. But it takes an immense amount of work and lobbying and grassroots outcry to move what really should be a no-brainer if you weren't looking at it from the perspective of corporate control of our food supply and the interests of the large entities, the big businesses, in not letting small farmers crack any markets.
No pun intended, or maybe major pun intended.
I didn't actually mean it, but yes.
Crack.
We'll take it.
You'd think that this would be a no-brainer, especially with the recent egg shortages, or was that part of the reason that it was harder to pass?
Oh, no. The egg shortages did help us because we were able to come in and go, look, they can't keep the grocery store shelves filled. Can you just let my small farmers who have eggs to sell them? What happened, actually, is the industry rep comes in and he goes, I'm not going to discuss graded or ungraded because all of the eggs come out of the same part of the chicken. So pretty much they're all the same. And here are basically these horrible pictures of what we have found in our industry eggs when we've done grading. And he shows pictures of half-formed baby chicks and cracked shells and dirty, filthy eggshells and all of these horrible things. And I'm sitting here going, and these are the pictures from your operations, not my small farmer's operations. So you can say all you like that an egg's an egg, but you're raising them 2 million chickens at a time. And our guys are raising them maybe a few hundred chickens at a time. And literally the owner who is responsible for that business, the farmer whose name is on that carton, is looking at those eggs before they go into the carton. That's a big difference. That is a world of difference in those eggs.
This is very interesting to me because I know in California, I have seen local eggs sold at some smaller stores. You certainly are not going to see them in the big stores, but I have seen some smaller ones that do that. And it makes me wonder, how does this vary state by state? Are there a lot of states that allow local eggs to be sold in stores, or is it something that is rather rare?
So it's not that there's a ban on local eggs, it's that they have to get a grading license.
Mm-hmm.
I think the law in California is still that they need a grading license. I'm not positive, but I don't remember seeing California's. Mm-hmm. I think there's maybe two states that have carved out not allowing grading. So my guess is, frankly, in the California stores, you're seeing one of two things. You're seeing there are some small farmers who've decided that it is worth it in their business model to go deal with the grading regs and the grading licenses, and they make it work. Actually, one of the farmers who came and testified in favor of our bill is one of those farmers here in Texas. They have a grading license. Now, they therefore were able to speak very well to what a headache it is, what it doesn't actually accomplish, and all of this. But for them, for their model, it has worked, and they sell to stores and restaurants graded eggs. And then there's some that just do it. And frankly, half the time, no one even knew what the regs was. I remember this was a while back, but for years, apparently, one of the well-known co-ops in Austin sold ungraded eggs. When I started in the early 2000s getting into regen ag, this Wheatsville co-op apparently was selling one of my farmer friend's eggs until a couple of years into it, the health department finally noticed and they're like, oh no, you can't do that. Their eggs are ungraded. You can't do it, and shut it down.
Also, I should mention that the ones I've seen in stores, they are smaller family farms. They're not the ones that have national deals with the major supermarket retailers, but I would say that they are toward the larger ones that you see in farmers markets. They'll be in a lot of farmers markets.
The larger end of our movement.
Right. So this would help the newer farms and the really small farms that maybe only do one or two, and that they would be the ones more that would be the benefit of not having to get it graded.
And even what you just said, the farmer who came and testified in favor of the bill, even though they got a grading license, they're on the larger end of our small farms, and it would have benefited them. They're okay, they're making it work, and he really did it more as a public service, which I really want to commend them for.
Mm-hmm.
But removing bad regulations is simply a good idea. It just gets so frustrating. I am not anti-regulatory, and our movement encompasses people from all ends of the political spectrum, which is what's wonderful and
absolutely
powerful about it. But speaking for myself, where I come in is I'm not anti-regulatory. I'm not a staunch libertarian that says just get government out of everything. But for crying out loud, can we base our regulations on actual data and facts and actual risk levels, as opposed to what we have, which is regulations that are written by and for the agribusinesses because they make the rules, because they have basically captured the government agencies and control the narrative around things like food safety.
A lot to be proud of with it. And I really appreciate it that even these larger farmers from the farmers market are supporting the smaller ones. I think that you see that with a lot. I think a lot of people who are family farms, they want to support the smaller ones as well.
It doesn't need to be a competition. First of all, we have literally a captive audience for our food. If you look at the food as a whole, everyone has to eat. Ultimately, everyone has to buy some farmer's product, whether that's after it's been processed and everything else and the profits go to the big corporations, or whether it's from one of our farmers direct to consumer or locally. So there's a really big pie out there for farmers to split up. And if the rules worked for farmers, everyone, including the larger farmers, would be so much better off. Because right now the rules don't work for any of the farmers. They work for the corporations that do the manufacturing and the distribution and the rest of it.
Totally, yes. And most of the farmers that interview, they support other farmers that, like you said, it's really not a competition, or at least not a competition in this end, because they're essentially all on the same team of supporting smaller, more traditional farming against the big ag.
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize that it's even literally the farmers that are outside our movement. I had a great conversation with someone just the other day. The farmers that often get demonized by the American public for using glyphosate and raising GMO crops and the rest of it, they're doing what they are told is the only way that their farm's going to make it. True or not, that is what they have been told by trusted sources, by industry groups, by ag extension. They are doing what they think is best for the farm, for the land, for the food. They're not the enemy. The enemy is the big deep pockets that are creating that narrative, that are funding the research, that are patenting the GMO seeds, that are driving this system. Those farmers, just as much as our farmers, they just want to take care of the land and raise healthy animals and get good food out to people. And the way they do it is the way that they're told is the best option.
And with small farmers and local farmers, I know another area that you've been working on, you talked about that a little bit earlier, is meat processing laws. Tell us about that.
So this is a huge area. And I think in our community, certainly the Weston Price community and the local food community, there's been a huge awareness for many years. And it exploded onto the public consciousness with COVID when the large slaughterhouses shut down, several of them, and all of a sudden grocery store shelves went empty. And people start going, how did the fact that three slaughterhouses shut down mean that my grocery store has no meat? And it was because those three or four slaughterhouses process 10% of the meat supply in the whole country. So people started to recognize, at least, that there was something wrong with this. And we've been working on meat issues long before that, because if you are telling farmers, well, what you should be doing is pasture grazing your animals and investing in the fences and the watering and all of this and everything you need to do good rotational grazing and prioritizing your animal health. It helps if there's a financial return on that. And the best way for them to get that financial return is to sell direct to consumer. They capture the most value. But you can't do it without inspected slaughterhouse. And there are mighty few small scale inspected slaughterhouses in this country compared to the number of cows in this country, or sheep or goats or pigs. And that is largely because of the regulations being so badly suited. They again are designed for the slaughterhouses that process 300 cows an hour. And we're talking about slaughterhouses that are processing maybe 50 cows in a week. The laws aren't designed for the small scale slaughterhouses. And between that and the consolidation of the industry, they're few and far between. So there are a lot of different levels that this needs to be reformed at. One is, first of all, trying to make the regulations a little simpler and providing support for small-scale slaughterhouses. And there's some good bills like the Strengthening Local Processing Act. The one we focus the most on is the next tier, which is the PRIME Act by Congressman Massey and Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. It's a bipartisan bill that would allow custom slaughterhouses, which they are regulated. This is not some Wild West show. These are regulated, licensed, inspected slaughterhouses. They just don't have the inspector on site while the processing is happening. To have that animal sent to the custom slaughterhouses and processed, the meat could be sold to consumers within the state. Now, these custom slaughterhouses are already, and some of your listeners may be well familiar with this.
Yes, I remember a few years ago, we did a whole show on the PRIME Act, which I recommend people go and listen to if they're not familiar with it after they listen to this one.
Yeah, people who are homesteaders or hunters are already using these slaughterhouses. And again, they have an excellent track record for safety. I mentioned the importance of track records earlier. There's a great track record of safety at these custom slaughterhouses. And then there's a whole nother layer. There's the Local Foods Act, which has been introduced by Senator Lee and Senator Welch. Talk about a fun bipartisan bill, very opposite ends of the political spectrum. And that addresses the personal exemption for on-farm slaughter. So if someone's willing to go buy a quarter of a cow at a time, but I want it processed on the farm, or maybe there isn't even a custom slaughterhouse nearby, there's no option, or they just care that much about animal welfare, or they want to do halal or kosher slaughtering, or whatever it is, they want it on farm, let's create a realistic option for them. And right now, USDA keeps flip-flopping about what's allowed under the personal exemption. And so this bill would simply set it up very clearly that someone can buy a share of an animal and arrange for it to be processed on farm by hiring a local butcher. And that's not regulated. At that level, we don't need government involvement. People are making this choice, and this is how they want to do it.
I think both of those are great examples of the bipartisan bills that you talk about. I remember at one of your conferences years ago, we had Thomas Massey and Shelley Pingree both giving the keynote, and Thomas saying how he liked working with Shelley more than members of his own party.
Yeah, I was so glad. They were on Zoom, but it was
right.
It was the best virtual presentation because they were going back and forth. We had them on at the same time, and the interaction and dynamic watching them was fantastic.
I think with food, there's a lot of efforts for bipartisanship because I think a lot of these are things that both sides will agree with are important.
It's hackneyed, but it's true. First of all, everyone eats.
Right.
It's the most fundamental area you can imagine for public policy. The other part of it is, before I started doing the policy work, I got converted, and I'll use that word intentionally, converted into regenerative agriculture. It was a paradigm shift. It was something I'd never really paid much attention to or cared much about. And I started really reading Alan Savory's work and Acres USA. And it became this incredible moment for me because what I saw and what I still see is by using natural systems, by mimicking natural ecosystems, and because of the energy of the sun that comes in every single day, this is not a zero-sum game. We can raise food in ways that are good for the environment, good for wildlife, good for animal welfare, good for human health, good for rural economies and small businesses. The only losers are large corporations and their shareholders. So it's such a wonderful, amazing thing because you don't have to go in and say, you have to give up on this in order for us to have this benefit. I can go to any Democrat or any Republican and find a way to explain to them that what I'm talking about is good for their constituents within their sort of political, philosophical paradigm.
So I know that the cottage bill and the egg bill were major things that got pushed through in Texas. Are there other pieces of legislation that you've worked on the past year or you're planning to work on the end of this year or 2026?
So another victory we had in the Texas legislature, which I'd love to see copied in other states, is we got through, it wasn't quite a statewide permitting bill, but it's awfully close. And what it says is if a farmer or any food business that grosses less than $1.5 million a year in sales, if they have a state health department permit as a retail food establishment or a food manufacturer, they don't need to also get a local permit. Because what you've got, and one of the problems our farmers have is, oh, I want to sell at that farm. There's a new farmer's market opening there. I'd love to sell it. Wait, I need to go fill out a whole other set of paperwork and deal with a whole other agency and get another fee. Oh, and if I want to sell to the grocer in that county, I need to get another set of paperwork and fill out another set of forms and pay another fee. And it's all based off the same regs. Again, this is not in any way undermining food safety to simply say, why are these farmers, small businesses, having to fill out multiple sets of paperwork, paying multiple fees, simply to sell the same food subject to the same food safety standards? And so that's gotten through in Texas. We have a very simplified permitting situation for small farmers and artisan food businesses.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a bill I'd love to see picked up and amplified. And what we're going to work on coming up, we're going to come back with the ag bill. We are going to spend some time talking to our farmers and really assessing, now that we have the vastly expanded cottage food law, now that we have effectively simplified statewide permitting, where are the barriers? Really sitting down and assessing, where are the things that are keeping our farmers from effectively being able to market and sell their products? And we'll build our platform off of that. We know meat processing's a part, that's continuing. And then we also want to work a lot on, this goes back to what I was saying about the farmers who are just doing the best they know with what they're being told. We need better education and information and tools so that more farmers are able to farm regeneratively, so that they understand what it is, and we have the tools for how it applies to their farm, their soil, their climate, their area. And so we actually worked on a bill this last session in Texas that would have funded regenerative ag research at Texas universities, prioritizing universities that receive less than a quarter of their funding from businesses that marketed synthetic inputs. So actually creating unbiased research where they weren't under pressure from their other funders to say, oh, actually, you know what? GMOs really are the better solution. This regen stuff is nonsense. So we didn't get that all the way through. It made it part of the way through bipartisanly. We got a supermajority bipartisan in the House, but just ran out of time. So I want to work on bills like that bill and others where we are going pragmatically, how do we get the tools into the hands of these farmers so that they can raise healthier food for their communities?
The regenerative bill, that sounds amazing. I'm pretty amazed at how regenerative agriculture, more people are becoming aware of it, because obviously you and I have known about it for a lot longer than the general public. Say 10 years ago, would you have thought that regenerative agriculture would have caught on the way it is now?
I kept waiting for the break that was going to make that happen. And unfortunately, I think what it's taken, and I'm not surprised, is how many people are sick, how many people are ill. I talked to staffer after staffer after staffer where it's their girlfriend has autoimmune, their cousin has autoimmune, they had a cancer scare, whatever it is. So much of this is driven by that. And I do think it's also driven by the parallel piece of people recognizing in all of the industries of our lives, how much is corporate controlled. The problem with large corporations that control the system and basically are able to sell cheap junk crap at high prices and reap immense profits, your average person gets screwed. And you can hardly point to an industry out there that's not true about now. And I think there's been a whole populist movement, and at its base, traditionally populism is simply about what are the interests of the average person. It's not the politicized term that it has become.
Right.
If you go back and you look into the early 1900s, the Grange and the populist movement in the early 1900s, it was not what we see now being described as populism. So we're not using it in that way. What is it about the average person and their interests? And it's what we saw lead to the antitrust and trust busting in the early 1900s. And I think we're seeing that movement. We're seeing people becoming aware. And as they become aware of it in other industries, and there are all these health problems that are linked to food, it's like, oh, wait a second. So wait, what's going on with my food? And that's where we see this coming together.
What are your thoughts on the different regenerative certification programs that these organizations are doing with products that we see in supermarkets and retail?
I think it's a difficult challenge when we enter certifications. There is definitely a role in them to prevent greenwashing. One of the problems we have, and we've seen it, is all kinds of greenwashing. So there's an importance to the certifications. On the other hand, certifications inherently favor somewhat larger industry and can easily become exclusionary. And so I think we always have to be looking at this. Let's leave space for the really small operations that aren't going to get certified just because it doesn't make sense. Not because they aren't doing it maybe even better, but because it just doesn't make sense. How do we ensure that they have fair access to smaller markets, not Walmart? They're not going to be in Walmart. And how do we make sure that those certifications don't themselves become greenwashing? How do we make sure that there's some rigor to the certifications? One of the older examples, which is still very much alive, is when USDA created its grass-fed certification. It was crappy. It was a horrible certification. At which point, American Grass-Fed Association, which is a fantastic nonprofit, was like, screw this, we're doing our own certification. You wouldn't listen to us. You put out something that's going to enable basically feedlots to sell their stuff as grass-fed just because they threw hay over the fence line instead of grain. We're going to create a real certification and be serious about it. And the AGA grass-fed certification is fantastic. So how do we prevent that sort of greenwashing that we saw with the USDA grass-fed certification?
Yes, that's a good question. And it's important to note that the USDA grass-fed certification, which is not even around anymore because I haven't seen any products with that, but I've seen many use the AGA certification. All of the regenerative certifications, they are private organizations. We haven't seen a government certification of regenerative yet.
There's still a real risk of greenwashing because the question is which private organizations?
Well, that's a big issue, yes.
There's a whole environmental regenerative circle and Tyson's at the table. There's part of me that's like, yay, let's bring Tyson along. But there's another part of me that's like, and what are the odds that this is going to be really rigorous, good quality stuff? What are your chances? So yeah, even with private certifications, I don't think we automatically eliminate the risk of greenwashing.
Oh, certainly not. And I have heard from a lot of smaller farmers very much what you're saying, of they have issue with this whole regenerative certification and what it does to them. So that is a very important topic to address.
Well, and I think there's a couple of things. One of the things I talk about in the regulatory scheme is needing a web of our system. So not a one-size-fits-all regulation. There should be regulations that are appropriate for large-scale operations that are shipping stuff all over the world. There's a different set of regs that are appropriate for a large-scale operation, but that's staying within a certain geographic region. And then small folks just selling direct to consumer. These are different types of operations. And I think we need to look at our food system, and the goal would be a complex, diverse system. And that's hard to do. We don't like complexity. Human beings like simplicity, particularly in our economic and government programs. But what we need, what's healthy, is complexity, is diversity. So let's look at how do we ensure that consumers know enough and the information is accurate, which is a key piece of having your free markets function. A free market only functions with full open flow of information. So let's make sure that when we set up certifications or when we recognize certifications, that it's done in a way that maintains open choices for consumers. So small farmers that aren't certified still need access to enough markets that consumers could choose to buy from them, and the information to be able to make an informed choice of whether they prefer that or they prefer the certification. And that's not easy, but it's possible.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's difficult, but I like to be an optimist and believe that can be done. Do you think that with a lot of these certifications and labels that we've seen in the past, that complexity is missing from all of them?
Yes. Yeah, I'll stop with yes.
Very fair. Yes. Moving on to some other national legislation, which I know that Farm and Ranch has been involved with. I know one was the protection from forever chemicals.
The polyfluorinated, but it's what we call the forever chemicals because they don't break down. They aren't going to go away. And there's a huge problem of them. They're used in all kinds of industries. They're used in our furniture. They're used all sorts of places. And so they concentrate. They're being found in very high concentration levels in sewage sludge, which is then being used as fertilizer all over the place. And so there's been a growing movement in just the last few years to address these toxic chemicals that are being put into the soil and that are just going to keep getting worse. They are forever chemicals. They're not going to break town and go away. And there's actually a very disturbing provision. Section 507 of the Interior Appropriations Bill would bury that report. It would cut off funding and not allow the agency to actually release the final report. And it would not allow for any policy to be proposed in reliance on that report. So here we are. We've got the information about what these forever chemicals are doing to human health, at least some of the information, doing to human health, and they don't want to let it see the light of day. And they're trying to kill it just through appropriations. So one of the things folks can do, here's an immediate action item, is call and say you're against Section 507 of the Interior Appropriations Bill. Bad things flourish in darkness. There needs to be some bright sunlight shown right on this so that they can't just slip it through and rest comfortable that no one's noticed it.
Yes. And for people wanting to know more about PFAS, I did a whole show on that a few years ago with Leah Segedy of Momovation, who's been a very big activist for reducing PFAS. So I recommend people do that. I like this. You're bringing up a lot of previous topics I thought before. If only there was a way somehow in podcasts you could link to older episodes, because you can't really do that on the website where you're listening to one and then something that goes to another.
Yeah, it'd be fun if there was some sort of live link.
Yeah. Oh, well, if I can find out how to invent that, that's my ticket. But for now, yes, I recommend learn about that. We've seen it very much from the activist side of learning more about legislation being done on it. I know also another piece of legislation that FARF is working on is the stop pesticide liability. So let's talk a little about that.
Yeah, so this is another one they're trying to sneak through in the appropriations bill. So here's the deal. Bayer bought Monsanto and somehow bought a lot of liability with it. Because who knew? Glyphosate causes health problems. What a shock. Sorry. At some point, I get so annoyed, I go sarcastic.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, sarcasm is certainly welcome on The Appropriate Omnivore.
And so there have been successful lawsuits holding Monsanto and now Bayer and its owner liable for immense sums of money because people have gotten extremely sick and they weren't warned about it. So one of the key parts of this lawsuit, and what's key to understanding what they're trying to do in Congress right now, is that the lawsuits rest a lot on, look, there are risks out there all the time, right? Lots of things happen. But when you have a label on it and you say, here's how you should use it, and you don't say, oh, and if you don't use it this way, or even if you use it this way, it can cause all of these health problems, that hooks in liability. That creates grounds for liability. And that's been one of the keys to these lawsuits. So what they're also doing in the same appropriations bill, or they're trying to bury the report about PFAS, is they're saying basically that you can only change the label on these pesticides if you go through this incredibly long process that usually only occurs once every 15 years, etc. Which first of all means we can't force them to label their stuff more accurately. Let's start with just that problem. We should be able to force them to label more accurately. It also means that the next time there's one of these lawsuits, they can be like, but we can't label it. Our hands are tied. We can't do it. There's a doctrine in law that then basically that's a defense that lets them get out of these lawsuits. So it serves effectively in practical terms to shield them from liability for the damage that their chemicals are causing. So while you're calling and you're saying you don't like Section 507 because it's burying the information about the health effects of PFAS, you can say, I also don't like Section 453 because if these companies make these chemicals, they should be liable when they cause harm. Let's just start with really basic principle. There is no good reason to shield profit-making entities from the harm that their products cause. If their products are so valuable and so important, they should absorb those costs. They should be able to pay for the harms that they've caused. And if they can't, if it's no longer profitable to make this product, if they have to pay for the harm it's caused, then they shouldn't be making the product. Again, hey, this isn't regular. This is basic free market. This is actual true free market principles where you as the seller and maker of a product should incur the true costs of those products. And that's the only way the free market actually works. Otherwise, what you have is a system where basically corporations are given a license to hurt people and make money off of it.
Very true. Very good points that you bring up. So lots of important legislation being worked on right now in the federal government. Are there any other national laws that FARFA is working on and advocating for?
So these are the main area. Most immediate issues are these appropriations bills because they will be going through very shortly. And so they're very dire in terms of time. We're working on the meat processing. We're working on regenerative ag promotion. There's always other pieces to the farm bill. There's so much that needs reform. But these are the hard-hitting core pieces for us.
Definitely. And certainly we'll be glad to talk about updates to those as they happen later on in the podcast. We're just about out of time, but before we go, let the listeners know where they can turn to on the internet and on social media to learn more about the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance.
Of course. So we have a website, farmandranchfreedom.org, all spelled out. You can sign up for free email alerts. We do not sell or share our lists. We respect people's privacy. And what you will also discover when you sign up for our emails is we will not send you past this button to send an email to your legislator, because those don't work. There's a whole other topic, but the short version is when you send a form letter to your legislator, it goes in the trash. They don't care about form letters. So when we send out alerts, it is telling you how to send a direct email or a phone call. Only it'll take you a couple of minutes, and it'll have 100 times the impact of pressing that little button that sends the form letter. So that's what you'll get when you sign up for email alerts with us. And of course, we're also a membership-based organization and ask for people's support as members to help us keep doing this work. We're also on Facebook and Instagram under Farm and Ranch Freedom, and folks can follow us on social media there.
Excellent. Yes, and they can learn a lot more in depth of what we've talked about in this program. Judith, I always love having you. I learn so much whenever you're a guest, so I appreciate you taking the time to come on this podcast right before the Wise Traditions Conference.
Of course. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Absolutely. That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. New episodes of the show released every Wednesday. Follow me on social media for more information on the next episode. And to make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore on your favorite podcast site or app. You can also listen to all my podcasts on my website, appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. Until next time, my pantry is officially closed.